Chapter 9. It turns out Sam's not an alien. John Smith, though? He's a different story. So, I say, trying to wrap my head around everything Sam has said. He really is a good alien. I just told you everything I know about him, Sam says. If you're not convinced that he hasn't been tainted by the dark side yet, I don't think you ever will be. Why didn't you guys tell everyone about all this sooner? Recorded some better commercials, maybe. Put on, like, a protest or something. Sam turns to me, squinting his eyes. Do you really think a protest would have stopped them? No. But at least we would have been prepared for this shit. We could have nuked them in space or something. He shakes his head. You were listening when I said some of the government is in on this, right? Damn, I mutter. Guess you got a point. We're a few subway cars away from where we left John sleeping like a rock. Benny used to pass out that hard sometimes, though it was always from too many beers, and would be completely immovable until morning. I'm guessing John's not waking up anytime soon either. As weak as my body feels, I can't say I blame him. I carry a knockoff Prada purse slung over my shoulder. Sam's got a tote that says music is my bag on the side. Scavenging was Sam's idea. He said it was in case we had to make a speedy exit and didn't have another time to loot the train. But I think he was just hungry, which, after having hurled earlier and spending most of my night running, I totally understand. Luckily for us, whatever happened to this train caused a lot of people to leave their ship behind. I've already found some meal bars, little 100-calorie packs of cookies, and even a few bottles of water. Not to mention a couple of phones, which is great because my battery is dead. No luck on finding a mobile charger or something yet. Not that I'd get any signal all the way down here, even if the network was up. You're heading down to Wall Street, right? Sam asks. He's on his hands and knees, fishing a plastic bag out from under one of the seats. Yeah, I say. That's where my mom works. She waits tables, sometimes bartends. The restaurant's nice as hell. Lots of rich bankers. That's cool, I guess. He stands back up and looks at me all serious-like. Do you have any idea? He trails off, but I know what he's getting at. She called me when it all started, I say. Told me to go home. Then there was some kind of... I struggle with the word. Loud noise. An explosion, maybe. I'm not sure. I had no idea what was going on. Didn't realize what was happening until I got home and saw your boy John on the news, beating up on that big alien guy. Citrus Ramen or whatever. Cetricus Raw. Or whatever, I repeat. Anyway, I haven't had a signal or anything since then. I'm sure she's fine. She's tough. Well, not really. She's the nicest, most loving person ever. But she's a survivor. Sam looks like he wants to say something, but I'm so physically and mentally and emotionally tired that I just hold a hand up and walk away. If we keep talking about this, I'm going to break down. Daniela, Sam starts. Here, nerd, I say, holding a granola bar I've just found on the ground out to him, cutting him off. He looks at it for a second. Wait, why am I a nerd? Why does everyone assume that? I shrug. Just a guess. You've got that vibe coming off of you. He looks like he's about to protest, but he doesn't. Instead, he takes the snack. You don't like these? No, I lie. I stretch and yawn. Sam does too, like it's contagious. I'm so exhausted that I'm wondering if I could use my newfound powers to float myself back to the car where John is.
We should head back, Sam says. Get some sleep. We're no good if our energy's zapped.
I can't believe I'm about to sleep in a subway car. I wonder what Mom would say.
There's a whole other half of the train we haven't gone through. We can hit it in the morning. Then we should get above ground and see.
He doesn't finish. I don't ask what he's wondering. I've got too many questions of my own going through my head. Too many grisly images of what might be happening on the surface.
I shake my head. We start back the way we came.
You were at the UN earlier? I ask.
Yeah. It was crazy.
How come I didn't see you fighting?
Hey, I was doing my best, he says. Besides, I didn't have these legacies yet. And I haven't exactly trained with guns that much.
Legacies? I ask. John used that word when we were on the street. Is that what you call the telekinesis and his light-up hands?
Yeah.
I twist my lips a bit.
It's kind of a dumb name.
Wait. Oh, shit. Did someone die for me to get these? Did I inherit, like, alien ghost powers? That's messed up.
I don't think so, Sam says.
I mean, I think they're passed down from those elders I mentioned earlier, for John and the Lorik, but as far as we're concerned,
he shrugs.
So you don't have any idea why we were chosen? I ask, as we step across the gap between two cars.
What's so special about us?
He shakes his head, and I can tell that this has been on his mind.
Man, he says, I've been asking myself that all day.
Honestly, until we met you, I thought I was the only one. His voice gets a little quieter.
I thought maybe I was being rewarded for helping the Lorik.
Well, I sure as hell wasn't being rewarded for anything, unless this is some kind of weirdo prize for finally getting my grades up in school. I think about this for a second. Guess that really doesn't matter anymore. Harlem, and the diner, and my apartment seem so far away. Was I really sulking over headphones earlier today?
Whatever the reason, I'm going to use them.
Sam nods as he talks, like he's telling me the most important thing in the world.
Now I can finally help everyone else. I won't be stuck on the sidelines. I can protect my friends. I can protect the planet.
Right, I say. John's whole pitch from earlier comes back to me, about how I should use these powers to help him win a war. Sam's obviously on board. Maybe it'll be you on TV fighting aliens next time.
He smiles a little bit.
Maybe.
I don't know that I'll ever look like John when I fight, though. He's a hero.
He sounds so genuine when he says it. There's such awe and respect in his voice.
It makes me wonder.
Are you two, like, a thing?
Sam looks confused for a second. Suddenly, he understands what I'm asking.
We're...
He hesitates. Best friends, I guess? We both have...
He pauses again.
Girls,
he finally says, a little awkwardly. I stare at him for a few seconds. Then I shrug.
Because it's totally cool if you are. We're not a thing.
I know. You both have...
I pause dramatically.
Girls? Sam rolls his eyes and jumps across into the car we left John in. He's still out, snoring a little.
It's just a complicated situation. His girlfriend is with her ex-boyfriend right now, trying to expose the Moogs. They're the ones who made that video you saw. They've got some mysterious hacker friend on their side who's helping them uncover classified government info. And my... The girl I've been... Oh, man, I'm not sure what Six is doing right now. She's in Mexico looking for a Lorik sanctuary.
Your girlfriend's name is Six? I ask.
Weird. Sam looks up at me. That's what's weird to you out of all of this? I shrug, and then let out a massive yawn.
I know, Sam says with a smirk. Intergalactic space wars and the fate of the world are so boring.
Shut up, I say, trying not to yawn again. With so many tunnels caved in, I doubt anyone's going to be down here looking for us. But we should probably sleep in shifts just in case, he says.
I'll take first watch and wake you when I start to fall asleep.
I guess. You sure you won't just immediately pass out on me?
Are you kidding? I've got granola bars and...
He pulls a crumpled plastic bag out of the tote.
Someone left their entire comic shop haul down here.
Yep. Nerd. He kinda grins, then gets a sad look on his face. Hey, he says quietly. I hope your mom's all right.
My dad?
He was missing for a long time. There were days I thought I'd never see him again.
Logically, it made sense to move on, but I never really gave up hope.
Eventually, we were reunited. I'm not saying it's the same thing, obviously. But you just have to keep fighting and believing. You have to honor the person who's not there with your actions. He shakes his head.
Sorry. I'm really tired. I think I'm rambling now.
Thanks, I murmur. For real. I ball up the fake Prada bag and use it as a pillow on one of the benches, turning away from Sam and John, my face almost touching the back of the subway seat. I'm too tired to even care about how gross it is to be lying here. Instead, now that it's finally quiet, and I'm not running or foraging for snacks and left behind electronics, all I can think about is her. The uncertainty. Sam's words repeat in my head. Tears start to come, silent, and pooling on the seat in front of me. They take away my last drop of energy. And before I know it, I'm asleep.
Chapter 10. I wake up with a start.
Turns out fighting aliens all night and then sleeping on a gross subway bench doesn't make for the best sleep. Half-realized nightmares about Mom linger in my head as I get over the initial shock of waking up in a strange place. My eyes burn from lack of sleep, and the pounding in my head is back. For some reason, I think of school when we had to read the Iliad and learned about Greek gods and stuff. I remember that one of the goddesses broke out of her dad's skull. Aphrodite, maybe? Or Athena? Whoever it was, that's how my head feels. Like someone's taking a bat to the inside of it, trying to get out. It's weird the thoughts that cross your mind when you wake up on a stalled train with an alien and his super-powered human sidekick. The subway car is pitch black, except for the faint glow of a cell phone in Sam's hands. He's sitting straight up in one of the seats, past the F out. A handful of comic books have slid onto the floor in front of him. So much for keeping watch, or waking me up. I get up and stretch, and walk over to him. There's drool coming out of one corner of his mouth. I wonder how he can sleep so soundly with everything that's going on, but I guess he's had more time to process the idea of aliens being real than I have. I slip the phone out of his hand, which doesn't get any kind of reaction from him at all. I probably couldn't wake him up if I tried. The cell phone tells me it's just after 5 a.m., I don't know if the sun would be up above ground yet. Don't even know if there is a sun still, actually. I turn the phone's flashlight on and wave it around our car. John hasn't moved. I keep the light on him long enough to make sure his chest is still moving up and down before turning my attention to the big duffel bag of cash sitting under the bench I slept on. I haven't actually looked through the bag, so I unzip it, in case there are weapons or something inside we can use. I find myself looking down at more money than I'd ever know what to do with. I pick up a wad of hundreds and think about what this money would have meant just 24 hours ago. Everything. And now? Who knows? The future seems so uncertain. The money is the only thing in the bag. I stand, spreading a fat stack of cash out into a half circle, and then fanning myself with it as I try to figure out how far away I am from Canal Street, or whatever the next subway station is. But I don't know where I'm at. Not for certain. My light falls on the closed train doors. I could just leave now. Take my bag and go. These guys would be fine without me. It's not like when the tunnel was falling in around us. They'd wake up and move on. Keep fighting. Keep fighting. Sam's words. Maybe it's because I only got a few hours of sleep. Or maybe it's because evil aliens attacked our city. Whatever it is, I suddenly feel so lost and alone. So much so that I almost shake Sam to try to wake him. I could just pretend to be ragging on him because he fell asleep. But he needs his rest. They both do. Regardless of whether I go out on my own or stay with them, I'm going to need some supplies. Even if I have a dozen phones on me, if I get lost in the tunnels, I don't want to risk being stuck with a bunch of dead batteries. So I pocket the cash and start down the other half of the train that Sam and I didn't get to. It's pretty much the same scene as the cars we explored last night. A lot of trash on the floors, a couple of purses and grocery sacks every now and then with usable supplies. I find a few more phones and two giant Whole Foods bags full of groceries, probably $100 worth. My stomach growls. I dig out a jar of almonds and eat them by the handful as I continue. 3 cars into my search, I find a small blue book bag on one of the seats. There's a baggie of baby carrots and an applesauce pouch in the front pocket. The big zipper compartment holds a stuffed animal and some picture books. This is some elementary school kid's bag. Maybe even a preschooler. Left behind when the train stopped for whatever reason. Suddenly, I don't feel so hungry anymore. I take a seat with the bag in my lap, feeling a little woozy. I try to shine the light of the phone out the window, but it just reflects off the glass. There's nothing but darkness waiting for me outside, and the idea of going through the dark tunnels by myself seems crazy. But then, everything seems crazy now. I concentrate on the book bag. It floats away from me and bobs in the air. I look down at my hands. This power. What am I supposed to do with it? I realize now that I've been running, mostly literally, ever since I first took out the Moogs with my telekinesis. I haven't had time to just sit and think about what all of this means, what my next steps are. I've had such tunnel vision about getting down to Mom's restaurant that I haven't let myself consider what happens if she's not there. That hasn't really even been a possibility. What would I give to go back to the diner eating waffles? To walk with Mom right now? I'd even be nice to Benny. Would see him in a whole new light. How does life get so messed up so fast? Yesterday morning, I was just a normal girl. My biggest concern was getting some new headphones. And now? Now everything's different. I'm different. I'm powerful. And the world is falling apart. But maybe I can help stop that. I'm just not sure what I'm supposed to do. Honor the person who's not there with your actions. My hands start to shake, and I make the kid's bag return to my lap, where I hug it tightly. I wonder what its owner is doing now. I hope to God that he's safe. Maybe the kid and his parents made it to the Brooklyn safe zone John and the guy on the radio talked about. Brooklyn. I try to put things into perspective. This whole time, I've been counting on Mom being down at her restaurant, hiding, safe. But realistically, that's not what she'd be doing, right? Not if she survived. She'd come looking for me. She'd try to make her way up to Harlem. She could be anywhere. Or maybe she was taken to Brooklyn against her will. If she was hurt, they might have sent her there. Or if the army finally showed up, they might have forced everyone to evacuate. She was pretty close to the Brooklyn Bridge at work. Maybe she's there now, waiting for me. Maybe Brooklyn is actually my best shot at finding my mom. And John and Sam can help me get there. I realize that I've started rocking in the seat, and at that moment, the last place I want to be is all by myself in an abandoned subway car, alone with my thoughts. I've got to get moving again. If the sun's not up yet, if it's still there, it will be soon. A new day's starting. My mom will be wondering where I am. I stand up, putting the little blue book bag on the bench carefully. Then I take a deep breath, gather up the rest of the stuff I found, and return to the car where my new weirdo friends are sleeping. When I get back, I try to sit still and wait for the boys to wake up on their own. I check the battery power on some of the cell phones I've collected, leaving a few fully charged ones on to try to make the inside of the train car feel less depressing. After a minute or two, though, I start to worry that they're both going to sleep all morning, and I'm too fired up to get going again to wait for that. So I cough a few times and chuck the fake Prada purse onto the seat over by John's head. He bolts straight up. "You're alive," I say. I don't have to fake my smile. John seems groggy, but that doesn't keep him from going pretty much straight into another recruitment speech, after giving me some shit for having a duffel bag full of money. As if I'm some kind of common thug. Like he even knows me. I don't know where he gets off with this, "I know everything you should be doing with your life" tone. He gets all serious and tells me about how he was too young to fight back when the Moogs came for his planet, but that I'm not, and can make a difference on Earth. The words make sense. Maybe if I wasn't so scared about Mom, and the aliens, and everything, I'd jump at this chance. I don't know. It's hard to process right now. John's not as smart as he thinks he is. He doesn't even know about the YouTube video of him they've been showing on the news, and he gets the dopiest look on his face when I tell him about it. Eventually, he wakes Sam up and tells us we should get moving. Before I agree to come along, or even ask where they're going, I want to know everything he does about what's happening in Brooklyn. "You mentioned getting some people out of New York."
"Yeah," John says. "The army and the police have secured the Brooklyn Bridge. They're evacuating people from there. At least, they were last night."
I nod. In my head, I try to figure the odds of where Mom could be. But it's all just guesswork. I could try to make it down to her restaurant alone. Or I could go to Brooklyn with two dudes who can move stuff with their minds and shoot fireballs and see if she's there first. It would be nice not to be alone in this search, especially if there are still Moog squads roaming the streets. "I'd like to go there," I say, getting to my feet. "Maybe see if my mom made it."
"All right."
He gets a smile on his face like he knew I was going to ask something like that. I roll my eyes and start for the door. What a punk.
"We should head that way too," he says.
"Whatever," I murmur, even though a wave of relief crashes over me when he says this. I don't know that either of them heard me. That doesn't really matter. I'm glad they're coming along, that I don't have to go alone. Sam yells at me not to forget my duffel bag. I lock eyes with John, ready for him to give me some spiel about how this money should go towards Earth's war fund or something. I know I said similar stuff to Jay about this earlier, but I do not need a lecture from John Smith about...
Use your telekinesis, he says, pointing at the bag. It's good practice.
Okay. Maybe he's not such a Boy Scout after all. I shoot him a grin and head out the doors, the bag floating after me. Today is going to be different. Today I'm going to find Mom, and we're going to pick up the pieces. I'm one step out of the train car when I see guns pointed at me. My hands go up, and I'm ready to scream and use my telekinesis. Then I realize the guns aren't like the Moog blasters. These are human guns, held by human soldiers. Oh, shit. I'm under arrest. Earth's going to shit, and I'm going to prison for taking money I technically didn't even steal. Whoa, I say, as I step back into the train, using my powers to try to hide the bag under one of the seats. I see John move out of the corner of my eye. His hands are on fire.
Wait, Sam says. They aren't Moogs.
One of them recognizes John as they shine flashlights in our faces. I notice that they don't immediately put their guns away. Friends of yours? I ask.
Not sure, John says.
Sometimes the government likes us, other times not so much, Sam says.
Great, I murmur.
I've done a hell of a job picking my friends. For a second there, I thought they were here to arrest me. Some woman's voice comes out of one of the military dude's walkie-talkies. I see John stiffen a little when he hears it. The guy steps forward.
Please come with us, he says. Agent Walker would like a word.
I glance at John, who nods at me. I guess Walker is a friend. Hey, where are we going? I ask.
The Brooklyn evacuation zone,
the soldier says, before turning around and heading back into the tunnel. I guess things are finally looking up. I don't know how to explain my duffel bag to these dudes, so as much as it pains me to do so, I leave it. Somewhere between spring and canal, I repeat in my head. I'll be back for you. Mom and I both will.
Chapter 11. In front of the Brooklyn Bridge, I see tanks in person for the first time. They're bigger in real life, with their guns pointed into the city, like they're going to fire on Manhattan.
Whoa, I whisper as we walk by.
I follow John and Sam, who follow some soldiers. They treat John like he's hot shit, calling him sir and stuff. I can't help but smirk every time they do. Don't these fools realize John Smith is only 16? I get that he's like the guy everyone knows about thanks to him fighting at the UN, but he should be going to prom or something, not getting treated like he's the president. I guess it could mean I'm not the only one who feels a connection to John. Maybe these soldiers feel it too, and that's why they treat him with so much respect. Or it could be that getting people to follow you comes with having legacies. I'm still trying to catch on to how all this works. Heading away from the city, it's almost like nothing bad ever happened. Brooklyn looks untouched in front of us. If it weren't for all the people in uniform and the lack of tourists hanging out on the bridge, I could imagine that I was just out on a nice walk with Mom, clearing my head. Once we got to the Brooklyn side, we'd have a slice of pizza and sit in the park and just look out at the water for a while. Quiet, but together. It's a nice image, but when I turn to look back at Manhattan, the whole dream falls apart. Plumes of smoke rise from all over the city, including downtown. The skyline looks different than it was the last time I was on the bridge months ago. I swallow down the lump that suddenly formed in my throat, hurrying to catch up with the others. On the other side of the bridge,
The park's been turned into some kind of combo hospital and military base for the National Guard, and whoever else has shown up from the Pentagon, or wherever all the military higher-ups hang out. There are people everywhere, in various states of injury and unrest. A few Red Cross stations have been set up, handing out supplies and bottles of water. Most everyone's got dust and blood on them. Looking down, I realize I'm no different. Buses seem to be carting people off to somewhere else. Somewhere safer, I'd guess, farther away from the city. There are a few tables set up where people look like they're signing in. My heart flutters. I turn to one of the soldiers. They have a list or something I could check? I'm looking for someone.
Sure, he says. You could ask.
He's not very helpful. I'm about to point that out when I realize John's staring at me. I start.
Go, John says. I hope you find her.
I force a smile. I realize I don't know when I'll see him or Sam again. About that whole saving the world thing?
When you're ready, come find me.
You're assuming I'll ever be ready, I snort.
Yeah,
he says,
eyes looking all serious. I am.
I nod, raise my chin up at Sam, and then run towards one of the sign-in stations. There's a line dozens of people long, and it takes everything in me not to bat them all out of the way with my thoughts and jump straight to the front. This where people are checking in? I ask an older Asian guy in front of me. All he does is nod a little. His eyes are wide, and he looks like he's in shock, like he might pass out at any moment. He turns away from me. Others in the line are louder. Some cry. A few just keep talking about how they're going to kill every alien they see as soon as they find a gun. I keep quiet, wishing I'd brought one of the phones with me, or that I had my headphones. Even the broken ones, which are back in an apartment I might never get to return to. Without music, or some kind of distraction, I'm left alone with my thoughts. I worry. After what feels like hours, I'm finally at the front of the line. Can I get your name? A woman asks. Her hair's tied back in a black bandana, and there are dark bags under her eyes. I wonder how long she's been at this. Daniela Morales, I say. Look, I'm trying to find my mom. We're just taking information here, she says, looking up from her electronic tablet. There are systems being put into place at our secondary evac site to connect missing persons. The bus will take you there once I have your info. But I need to know if she's there, I say. If she's not, I'm not sure what to say next. I'll go back to Manhattan? Would they even let me back across the bridge? Doubtful, but I could find a way. The woman's eyebrows draw together, and she purses her lips. She looks like she's tired of hearing this. I'm guessing I'm not the first person trying to find someone I love. If you'll spell your full name, she starts. You're checking everyone in? My mom's name is Roxanne Morales. She's a waitress downtown. Please, can you just look? She looks at me for a few seconds. I can feel my eyes stinging. Finally, she taps on the electronic screen a few times. After scrolling through some lists, she lets out a small sigh. She doesn't say anything, just looks up at me and shakes her head. The stinging gets worse. Morales, I say again. M-O-R-A-L-E-S. I'm sorry, Daniela, but there's no Roxanne Morales in my database. Now we're only getting updates from the other sites every hour or so. Maybe she went to one of the other evacuation points farther uptown. I shake my head. My fingers grip the edge of the table in front of me. I don't want to leave. I can't walk away. No. She worked in the financial district. The woman's eye twitches a little.
Where, exactly?
She asks. Where does she work? I tell her the location. Just off Wall Street, not taking my eyes off hers. I'm so focused that I don't even notice she's moving her hand until it's on top of mine.
That area was hit really hard in the initial attack, Daniela,
she says quietly but firmly.
We haven't seen many survivors from that location. There's always hope, but our rescue teams are still having trouble navigating much of downtown. The best thing for you to do is to give me the rest of your info and go to the secondary site. That way, if your mom comes through here, she'll... I run. I don't know where I'm going. I just go. The woman shouts my name but doesn't follow. I pass a makeshift emergency room. Doctors, injured bystanders, firemen, policemen who look like they haven't slept in days. National guardsmen and women eye me as I pass by. But no one stops me. I keep going, until I finally find myself down by the water, staring at the smoke rising from Lower Manhattan.
We haven't seen many survivors from that location. She told me to go home. There was an explosion. Of course it was an explosion. No matter how much I try to tell myself that it wasn't. And then, silence. We were disconnected. She was gone. Mom's not here. She could be dead. She's probably dead. My eyes start to water. I can feel them getting red as I clench my fists and think of all the things I've done to get to her. To get here, only to find that I'm no closer to reuniting with her. The people in the park, the bus, the bank, almost dying in a tunnel with Sam and John. Maybe I should have gone to the restaurant after all. Hell, maybe I should have stayed hidden in our apartment or somewhere in our neighborhood and waited for her to come back. I could have fought the Moogs off, probably.
Maybe. What would she have wanted me to do?
And then, new words start to float through my head. Sam talking about his dad, and how he didn't give up hope. She could still be out there. She could be fighting her way uptown to find me. Or hiding out somewhere safe, waiting for the right moment to run. Or she's at another evacuation zone, for all I know. I still have to have hope. I mean, shit, I've got telekinesis. Anything is possible. You have to honor the person who's not there with your actions. What would Mom want me to do now? They're screaming behind me, and I turn expecting to see a bunch of Moogs. Instead, I watch a stretcher rush by. There are two people in scrubs, young, nurses maybe, pushing it towards one of the medical tents. The woman lying on it is covered in blood. Another woman chases after them, holding her hand out in front of her, tears streaming down her face. I don't know which of them screamed. It could have been the nurses, or someone else in the safe zone, for all I know. There are plenty of reasons to be screaming or crying or shouting here. We've all lost something. Who knows how many people are just like me right now, trying to find someone who means the world to them in the middle of all this shit. I turn back to the city and wipe the hot tears from the sides of my eyes. My gaze lands on the giant spaceship hovering above the city, just waiting to attack us again. John and Sam called it the Anubis, I think. I have other words for it, most of which Mom would be pissed at me for saying out loud. My fists curl into balls at my sides. I know one thing for sure. If my mom is still alive, she's not safe while those bastard aliens are here. None of us are. I'm not giving up on you, I say quietly, hoping that wherever my mom is, she can hear me. I'm going to see you again. But until then, I think I'm going to kick some alien ass. Help some people. Make you proud. I turn and start running again. This time, I know where I'm going. I have to find John Smith. I can't just sit around here with the rest of the evacuees, or I'll lose my damn mind. I'm going to do some good. I'm going to fight.
Last Defense.
Chapter 1. The Moog skimmer rises above Ashwood Estates and shoots off towards the horizon. Six, Marina, and Adam are on board. A handful of kids, teenagers technically, but still children to me, ready to cross the continent in search of a place called the Sanctuary. Somewhere they only know about, because years ago, during one of the many gaps in my memory, I told the Moogs it existed and that it was important to the future of the Lorik. I hope for our sakes that this is true. Earth is facing invasion, and we need all the help we can get. I've been racking my brain trying to remember anything else about this place that's apparently so important to the Lorik. Any details at all, but I come up with nothing. And there's not really time to dwell on recovering these memories. I have so much else to worry about. The most important thing is my son, Sam. He's putting himself in danger. Again. He's about to head to New York with John and Nine and a few of the FBI agents who've joined our side in order to stop a corrupt politician and expose the Mogadorian threat. As I watch the skimmer disappear against the morning sun, I wonder what kind of father lets his only child get wrapped up in so much violence and death. I lose myself in this question, unable to find a suitable answer, until John Smith's voice breaks my daze.
Damn, this place looks like a war zone. I thought we'd gotten most of the fires out last night.
I turn, and find him stomping on a blackened spot on the grass, a wisp of smoke drifting up around his shoe. Behind him stands Adam's childhood home, the front windows knocked out from yesterday's fighting. Now, it's our makeshift base of operations. I think the remodeling you guys did is actually an improvement, I say, and then motion to a house towards the end of the block that's been completely demolished. I always hated these kinds of cookie-cutter houses. I'm attempting to keep things light, to hide my worry about everything that's to come, to put on a brave face. If I were you, I wouldn't mind seeing this place go up in flames either. He locks eyes with me, and smiles, but I can tell he's sizing me up. As the unofficial leader of the Lorik, John must think it's his job to worry about everybody. And it makes some sense that he'd have his sights on me. It wasn't long ago that I was in captivity in the facilities located far below our feet, the tunnels, research labs, and operating tables found underneath Ashwood, where the Moog's brutality was allowed to incubate and flourish. If not for Adam, I would have died here. Or worse. I can't fathom what worse might have been in my case, but I have no doubt that the Moogs are capable of something more terrifying than death. If anyone here is going to freak out, I'm the likely candidate. Still, it makes me feel terrible somewhere deep in my gut, like I need to prove my worth to the cause. Maybe I wouldn't feel that way if it hadn't been me who spilled so many Lorik secrets to the Moogs, even if it was against my will. That's one of the worst parts about not remembering so much of the last decade. All I have to show for those missing years is betrayal, pain, and the knowledge that my family was out there without any idea of what happened to me the whole time. I shake my head, trying to refocus my thoughts. One of the side effects of having my mind tampered with by the Moogs is that I'm easily distracted, prone to chasing long-forgotten memories like rabbits through Wonderland. I guess you're right, I say.
You should try to get some rest,
John says, a slight crease forming between his eyebrows.
Try not to overwork yourself. When was the last time you slept?
Who needs sleep when I've got coffee and Mogadorian home movies to watch? I ask, with a limp smile. I've been going over videos found in the archives below Ashwood since we took the suburb yesterday.
Thanks for helping out with that. Who knows what we could learn from those files? You're the only one here we can completely trust with important stuff like that, even if Walker's men are on our side now. He means this as a compliment, I'm sure, but there's a subtext to his words. He may not even realize it, but he's reminding me that there's no room for me on this upcoming mission. Someone needs to stay behind and sift through the data, and I'm just an old man who's pretty good with a rifle, not a fighter like they are. My place is here. He's a remarkably charismatic leader for his age. I have to keep reminding myself that he's really just a teenager, at the point in his life where he should be learning pre-calculus or chemistry. All these kids act like they're 10 years older than they actually are, except perhaps for Nine, whose personality seems to have stalled at the age of 13. John nods to a large hawk, perched on a tree limb above us. The Chimerae are patrolling the area in case the Moogs realize that no one's checking in with them from Ashwood and decide to investigate. If the Moogs really are gearing up for an invasion, they'll likely have more important things to worry about than Ashwood, I say. Still, they've got your back. Plus, he takes a look around, making sure there's no one in earshot. Walker and her crew are helping us out for now, but I feel better knowing the Chimerae will protect you just in case anything happens. They'll look after you until we get back. Do you know how to whistle?
Sure.
Good. Gamera up there is your new personal bodyguard. You whistle and he'll come running, or flying, or whatever. He shrugs a little. That was Sam's idea. He thinks you've got a soft spot for Gamera since you named him. Anyway, I told all of them to stay out of sight for the most part. Walker's agents know what they are, but if anyone else shows up, they've got instructions not to morph in front of them. The fewer people who know about the Chimerae, the better. The front door springs open, and Sam starts down the porch, holding a plate piled high with yellow discs. One of them hangs out of his mouth, flapping as he jumps down onto the lawn.
"Dude, they've got frozen waffles in there,"
he says to John as he chews.
"I don't know if they were Adam's dad's or if the feds brought them or what, but there are like 10 boxes in the freezer."
He shakes his head.
"All these waffles and no syrup. The monsters!"
"Sweet," John says, reaching for one. Sam shirks away, twisting around so the plate's out of reach.
"These are mine. Go get your own."
"I'd hurry, too. Nine keeps challenging the FBI dudes to arm wrestling matches, and I'm pretty sure Walker is about to sedate him or something." John shakes his head and looks at me again.
"Remember, just whistle."
Then he heads inside.
"Did you like that?"
Sam asks, his face lighting up.
"The whistling, I mean. It was totally my idea."
That's what John said.
"Brilliant."
He grins and holds out the plate. I raise my eyebrows.
"I thought those were for you."
"Just eat some waffles, Dad. I doubt you were raiding the fridge during your all-night cram session in the archives."
As if on cue, my stomach grumbles.
"See?"
He pushes the plate into my hands, taking 2 more waffles for himself.
"They're making coffee inside, but these agents are just as addicted to it as you. I tried to get a cup, and one of them actually growled at me."
"Sam," I say. I don't want to spoil his mood, but our time together is getting short. I know this isn't news to you, but this trip to New York might get pretty dangerous. If Cetricus Ra is planning on making a public appearance, and it goes wrong...
"I know."
He cuts me off.
"I'll be careful. If we get into a fight, I'll leave the heroics to the actual alien superheroes as much as I can. Don't worry about me. Just see if you can find something here that'll help us take down these Moog shitheads."
I give him an exaggerated sigh. "What would your mother say if she heard you talking like that?" As if cursing even registers as a problem at this point in our lives. I'm honestly not sure where this reaction comes from. I guess part of me is still trying to mask my concern, as if letting these kids know how scared I am about them, about Sam,
Going to the front lines might somehow destroy their seemingly limitless capacities for bravery. I'm kind of more afraid that when I get home after all this is over, Mom's going to chain me up in my room and never let me see the outside world again. Oh, speaking of, maybe I should call her on the drive and let her know I'm still alive. I think of my wife. The last time I saw her, when I showed up after years of being gone, only to discover that Sam was missing too. She wasn't exactly thrilled to hear that I blamed my disappearance on aliens. Since then, she hasn't been too keen on talking to me. Do that, I say. Just remember that her phone is probably tapped, so no details. I'll wait until I have something good to tell her. Then I'll call.
That reminds me. Here,
he says, holding a black satellite phone out to me. I pat my pockets, realizing I haven't been carrying mine around. Sam continues, "Yes, this is yours. Adam was messing with it. Apparently Earth's understanding of communications systems is really basic. This is supposed to get a signal, like, anywhere." Or so he says.
"Excellent," I say. "We should all start carrying these."
Sam shrugs.
"I guess. But you know how much fighting we get into. Electronics don't really last that long around us. That's why I'm giving it to you. I'll talk him into making me one whenever he gets back."
The door opens behind him, and John comes out, followed by Nine, Agent Walker, and a few other feds I haven't been introduced to yet.
"All right," Nine says with a smirk. "Let's go knock some evil politician heads in the Big Apple."
Sam rolls his eyes.
"Keep that phone with you, Dad. I'll call you when I have news."
He tries to give me a quick side hug, but I pull him in closer.
"Goodbye, son. Be careful."
"I will.
I'll see you soon."
And just like that, he's gone. These kids all think they're invincible, but they're not. Even some of the guard, with all their abilities, have been killed. For a second, I wonder if I can talk Sam out of going. Call him and tell him to get dropped off at a gas station or something where I can pick him up. He could help me sift through the years of Mogadorian data stored in the underground facilities. But I know he'd never agree to that, and I'm pretty sure I don't have the authority to flat out forbid him from going. He's already made so many tough choices on his own without me. Why would he listen to me now? Chapter 2 God knows I'd probably be more alert if I had a few hours of sleep, but I can't imagine closing my eyes and drifting off while Sam is en route to New York. Not when there's work to be done. So instead, I manage to snag a cup of coffee from the pot in the kitchen and head back into the bowels of Ashwood. With any luck, I'll find some kind of secret weapon that'll take down the Moogs, or at least some information we can use against them. Anything to make me feel like I'm actually contributing. A long stairwell leads into the tunnels from a back room in Adam's home, plaster and brick giving way to concrete and eventually smooth metal walls, as I descend. Everything is hard, gray, and clinical. The hairs on the back of my neck start to prickle the farther down the steps I go, though I'm not sure if it's because the air is getting cooler or because terrible things happened to me here, even if I barely remember any of them. Gamera follows close behind me in the form of a dragonfly hovering over my shoulder. I nod to the Chimera. It's good to know my son is watching out for me, of course, but at the same time it makes me feel like a failure. I should be the one protecting him. The underground portion of Ashwood Estates is a labyrinth, a sub-level snaking through the entire community with tunnels that stretch on in twists and turns for what seem like miles. As if that weren't confusing enough, several of the passageways and rooms are completely caved in, something we have Adam to thank for, that eternity ago when he freed me from captivity here and let loose his newfound earthquake legacy. Who knows what hides behind the collapsed hallways, what knowledge we lost when equipment was smashed. If we weren't on the brink of losing the Earth, maybe we'd have time to find out. There are plenty of rooms still standing, though. Laboratories and detainment cells, for example. I pass them, eyeing strange devices and surgical tools that send shivers down my spine. This place is still dangerous to me, not just because of the questionable structural integrity, but because of the feeling I get when I walk through its hallways, the faintest wave of recognition followed by a stabbing pain in my head. There is something in the smell of the place, musty, charged with electrical equipment, that is familiar, like all the memories I've forgotten are just out of reach, waiting to be reclaimed. These tunnels fill every cell of my body with dread. Fortunately, most of that subsides when I reach the facility's archives. I don't think I ever entered it during my imprisonment because I can breathe a sigh of relief when I step through the doorway. That's not to say the room is exactly cozy, nothing like the dusty libraries full of books and overstuffed chairs from my days at the university. This archive is just as uninviting as the rest of the underground level. Monitors and computer terminals, line steel tables, their keyboards an unfamiliar shape and covered in markings I don't understand. Cabinets full of servers and hard drive storage banks line the walls, humming in tune with the fluorescent lights overhead. There's even a shelf holding a row of blasters on the far side of the room. The Moogs can apparently never be too far away from their weapons. I stretch, my back cracking, and take a seat at one of the metal chairs in front of a computer terminal. This is the little space I've made my own over the last day. A computer, a handheld electronic tablet, a notebook, a small duffel bag full of tools and documents that might prove useful, and a graveyard of dirty mugs. I put on a pair of headphones and flit through the list of Moog recordings on the screen until I find where I left off. Then I start watching. Apart from being ruthless warriors, the Mogadorians also seem to be absurdly thorough when it comes to recording themselves, though I'm not sure whether this is strictly for some kind of historical record, or is the byproduct of a fascist regime wanting to keep track of its many moving parts. I fast forward through dozens of videos, almost all of which are in the Mogadorian language and useless to me now that Adam is gone. Occasionally, I find one in English, but those are mostly communiques between human Moog Pro associates that contain either nothing useful or information we already know. I log anything of the slightest interest in my notebook. The whole process is mind-numbing, and at some point my eyes must start to glaze over because I don't realize someone else is in the room with me until there's a hand on my shoulder. I spin around, almost falling out of my chair as I try to get to my feet. The man behind me is an FBI agent, wearing a black suit. He's younger than me, maybe 30, with olive skin, short, dark hair, and several days' worth of stubble. On the stool beside me, Gamera has taken the form of a cat, eyes locked on the agent, ready to pounce and morph. The animal must have realized his usual turtle form might draw unwanted attention from the agents. The man holds out a hand. Agent Noto. Walker, he hesitates slightly, insisted that I might be a valuable resource to you. I wave my hand towards the feline at my side. I've already got a bodyguard. He doesn't find this funny. I continue. I'm sure your bureau skills will be more useful up there instead of watching me sift through alien data files. He smirks a little, but it's hard to tell if it's out of annoyance or amusement. I assure you I'm more than just a gun, Dr. Good. It's been so long since someone called me doctor that the word sounds strange attached to my name. I almost can't believe there was a time when students and colleagues called me that on a daily basis. Noto continues. In the past I served as a liaison to the Mogadorians, before we realized what their true intentions were. Ah, so you have a good idea of who we're dealing with. I can even understand some of their language, though I admit that I'm probably on the equivalent of a kindergarten level when it comes to reading it. Finally, a windfall. Please, I say, shaking his hand, call me Malcolm. He takes a seat on the other side of the desk, and I get him caught up, pointing him towards a set of files to examine. I try to explain that we're looking for anything useful, even if that's a vague description. He seems to understand. We work in relative silence for hours, talking only about our findings, comparing notes. It's fruitless work. I don't uncover anything particularly helpful, and Noto's progress is slow. He often spends 15 minutes on a file before realizing it's an order for more food supplies or inconsequential reports on traffic around Ashwood. Eventually, I open up a file that causes me to freeze, my heart pounding in my chest. I recognize the face of the human on camera. I can even give him a name, though it takes me a moment to pin it down in my head. Ethan. The problem is, I don't know why I know his face and name. The file appears to be a video conference between Ethan and a Mogadorian. Based on the tattoos, I'm guessing it's a high-ranking official. Ethan is reciting a list of names, giving facts about them and their locations. The words trigger something in my memory, illuminating one of the dark places I'd thought long lost. Faces flash through my head of men and women who helped the Lorik refugees when they first arrived on Earth, people I recruited. Greeters. That's when I realize who Ethan is. He had been one of them. A greeter. No, that's not right. He was going to be one, but I cut him loose before he fulfilled his duty for some reason. He wasn't there when the Lorik landed. There's something else. Just out of reach. I didn't trust him. But why not? As I continue watching, I start to understand a little more. He worked with the Moogs, a traitor detailing everything he knew about the Greeters and the Lorik, which wasn't much. Still, it was probably enough to give the Moogs a few leads. In fact, it sounds like the Moogs already had at least one of the Greeters captured at the time this video was taken, thanks to Ethan's information. I wonder, was it me? New images shoot through my mind. Some of the same faces as before, only this time they're pale, broken, bloodied. They're here, at Ashwood, being shown to me as a threat or a warning that if I don't tell Dr. Anu, the head scientist at Ashwood, everything he wants to know, I will end up like them. Dead. Murdered. I swallow down the waffles and coffee that are rising in my throat as Ethan continues to talk. Based on what he says, it sounds like the message is old. From before everything happened in Paradise, even so, Ethan lets a bombshell slip. He's been put in charge of training and recruiting Guard Number 5. He's already had contact with the boy. The video ends, and everything comes crashing down on me. Despite all the confusion and gaps in my memories, I know some things to be true. I was in charge of recruiting the Greeters. I must have brought Ethan on board at some point, even if I did kick him out of the group before the Lorik arrived. Ethan turned on us and likely molded 5 into the traitor he is now. And because of that, 8 is dead. It's an easy line to follow. The dots almost connecting themselves and creating a direct link from me to 8's corpse. I take my glasses off and squeeze the bridge of my nose, trying to shake the pounding that suddenly fills my head as these memories and realizations flood in. Not only did I give the Moogs knowledge of the sanctuary, I helped them turn one of the Lorik into a Moog sympathizer. Who knows what other terrible things I did while under their control, or that I accidentally set into motion just trying to help the guard. Will I wake up tomorrow and suddenly discover that I helped plan this invasion, too? How do I begin to atone for all this? I realize Noto is staring at me. His face is steely, but there's a hint of concern behind his eyes, or maybe suspicion? I'm fine, I say.
Just a headache. Maybe you should take a break, he suggests. Get some air. I nod, but make no effort to move. I'm sure none of this can be easy, coming back here, Noto says. Walker gave me a quick overview of what happened to you. It's kind of funny, actually. I investigated your disappearance from Paradise. He pauses. Well, I guess funny isn't really the right word. This is something I didn't expect. He looks far too young to have been involved in the case. You did? I ask. Not originally, but after the Moog incident at the high school. You know about that, right? I do. That's when our team went to Ohio. I spent some time looking into your old missing persons case. It was a hell of a puzzle, like you just vanished off the face of the earth. He squints a little, staring at me. You still don't remember what happened? Nothing about my abduction. I say with a sigh. I'm not sure I'll ever know what happened. I've tried putting everything back together. Strange things will trigger a memory, mostly just flashes of images and feelings. But even those are difficult to hold on to or understand. There are even missing spots from years before I was taken. Whatever they did broke me. They took so much of my life away. I can't imagine. I think of the greeters again, and of the video I discovered earlier where I'm drugged or brainwashed, being controlled in some way. That's probably a good thing, I say. The Mogadorians did terrible things here, to me and to others. Still, I'd gladly remember every excruciating detail if it meant having all my good memories back as well. When you put it that way, he flounders for the right words. It's a lot of lost time. I cock my head to one side a bit. Something he said earlier isn't adding up. Why were you looking into my disappearance? That was so long ago, and with everything that must have been happening after the attack on the school, surely you had more important things to worry about. Your son was a prime suspect and was missing. We couldn't rule out the idea that you were working off the grid somewhere with John Smith or the Mogadorians, even. If they had only told us they had you... He stops, realizing that he's digging himself into a hole, reminding me that while I was in a coma a few rooms down, he and the rest of Walker's agents were working with my captors. We didn't know. His eyes meet mine. He sounds earnest, though I can't tell if he's trying to convince himself or me. All the civilian casualties and detainments, the plans for invasion, Jesus, we just thought we were getting high-tech weapons and medical enhancements out of helping them find some alien fugitives. Anger bubbles in my stomach as he speaks. Not at him, but at all of it, the FBI, the Moogs, my imprisonment. I try to push it down and focus on what's important. Well, we'd better make up for both of our sins. Taking down the Moogs might not absolve us of the things we've done under their influence, but it sounds like a pretty good start to me. Noto nods a little. We sit in silence for a few moments before a new question comes to my mind. You were investigating Sam. What did you find? He takes a deep breath, looking a little relieved. Solid grades, exceptional aptitude in sciences. An understandable obsession with conspiracy theories in space. I wouldn't want to poke around the internet history of most teenagers, but Sam spent the majority of his free time researching faraway planets and talking about potential extraterrestrial sightings on message boards. I mean, he also pirated a lot of movies and music, but all in all, he seems like a pretty good kid. I can't take credit for any of that, I say, a pang of guilt in my gut. Noto shakes his head. You're telling me it's just a coincidence that your son grew up to become an ally to the Lorik? Something you did must have rubbed off on him. Now if only I can remember what that was, I say, trying to make a joke of it, but failing. I swear, if Anu and Zakos weren't dead already, I'd kill them myself. Noto's face suddenly twists, his brow furrowing. Who? Dr. Anu. He was the first Mogadorian doctor who... No, the other one, Noto says. He's not looking at me now, but tapping on the keyboard. Zakos, I mutter. He After Dr. Anu died, he was the one who oversaw my captivity. He was evil. I mean, they both were, but Zacho seemed to take pleasure in his experimentation. A Mogadorian Mengele. He almost killed Adam, from what I understand, but Adam got to him first when we escaped. Noto shakes his head. That was in the fall, right, when you escaped? Yes. Once I'd carried Adam out of the destroyed tunnels, sneaking away in the chaos and confusion, we crisscrossed the country trying to avoid being recaptured. Weeks flew by in a haze. We spent a lot of time sleeping in fields and living off scraps we found. By the time I figured enough time had passed and I dared to go back to Paradise to reunite with my family, Sam was gone. Right. Noto's voice is quiet, distant, like he's not really listening anymore. His eyes are locked on his screen. What is it? I've got a recording here of Dr. Zacho's. He raises his head and meets my eyes. It's from earlier this year. Whatever happened to him here? He survived. No, I mutter, coming around to his screen. That's not possible. Adam knocked him out, and then the ceiling came down around him when... But he's there, on the screen. In the background, his lab is in shambles, the walls cracked and floor covered in rubble. It's obviously after Adam partially destroyed the sublevel. He looks pleased with himself, black eyes shining in the paused image. It takes me a few seconds to comprehend what I'm seeing, but then it hits me in my chest. Dr. Zacho's, the butcher, the mad scientist, the monster, is still alive. He's still fighting against us. Somewhere, in the darkest parts of my mind, there's a strange flash. Not joy, exactly, but something like it, as I realize I might have the chance to face one of my former captors. It sounds like he's been called in for some top-secret project that Cetricus Ra is overseeing. Something they think will ensure Mogadorian victory. Before I can say anything, though, Noto's walkie-talkie crackles. Noto, get up here! Something's happening in New York!